This is Philosophy Bites with me, Nigel Warburton.
And me, David Edmonds.
If you enjoy Philosophy Bites, please support us. We're currently unfunded and all donations would be gratefully received. For details, go to www.philosophybites.com.
Suppose I discover something about myself, about the kind of person that I am, that I didn't know before. I might, for example, go through life thinking I'm quite generous, but then find out that I give a much lower percentage of my income away to charity than average. Is this new self-knowledge relevant to the question of how I should live? Regina Rinne is a philosopher, formerly at Oxford Uehira Centre and now at New York University.
Regina Rinne, welcome to Philosophy Bites.
Thanks very much.
The topic we're going to focus on is the moral self and psychology. Can we just begin with the moral self? What is the moral self?
Sure. So human beings or persons are distinct from lots of other creatures and objects in the world because we have a certain way of controlling ourselves. Self-control, I guess, is the key word here, right? We're not like animals. We're not like chairs. We're not like rocks. We're not just pushed around by forces of nature. And so we can sort of determine what we do. And morality, the questions about what we ought to do, arise from this fact that we can determine ourselves. And so this is a familiar theme in a lot of moral philosophy, the idea that we create ourselves as moral agents by making choices, by acting on those choices, by following through on those choices, and what we are as an individual, or what I am as an individual, as a moral individual who's held morally accountable and to whom moral concepts apply, is constituted from those choices and from those values.
So if I help somebody who's in great need, somebody has an accident in front of me and I help them, not because I've got a legal responsibility, but I see I've got some kind of moral obligation, how does that relate to myself? Is it because I just see myself as the kind of person who helps people?
Yeah, I think that's right. I think a lot of it's about how we see ourselves. It's that it makes sense to me to act in this way in this circumstance. It makes sense to me to stop and put down what I'm doing and help this person get up or collect their things or get to a doctor or whatever, because it makes sense to me that a person of the sort of person I see myself as would do that in this situation.
So the moral self is something that is akin to character, really.
Yeah, it has a lot of commonality with the concept of character. There are maybe some rough edges on the two concepts that don't match up perfectly, but I think that's right.
So I've got, as it were, a set of dispositions to behave in certain ways. What makes it a moral disposition? What makes it a moral self rather than just, that's how I am?
That's a really good question, and I think philosophers just disagree about that. I think one of the key points has to do with the way we relate to other persons. It's not moral just because I'm interacting with another person, but it's because I'm interacting with them with regard to them as another agent. So I'm thinking about them as another self-directed entity in the world. And this is basically just a Kantian point. If we think about ourselves and about other people as being distinctive from animals and objects in the world and that they're in control of themselves, then we're entering into this realm that is designated with this concept of the moral. Those are the kinds of choices that we think about in terms of moral evaluation.
You've mentioned choice a few times, and there's a sense in which morality is about not just how I happen to be. What sort of place does choice play in this notion of a moral self?
I think it's critical. Our concept of morality, of moral ought, wouldn't really be intelligible if we didn't take ourselves to be making choices. We take ourselves to have an option as to whether or not to do this or that, and the question is whether we ought to do this or that doesn't really arise unless we take seriously the thought that it's up to us whether or not we do it. In most people's minds, this immediately brings to mind questions about determinism, about free will, and all I'm saying at this point is that at least subjectively, phenomenologically, when you're imagining yourself making a decision, the way it feels to you as if you have a choice. There's a further question about whether or not that's true in metaphysical terms, but at least the way it seems to you as one who is making a choice, it does seem like it is up to me, and that's why the question is serious. What should I do, given that I get to decide?
So this is a serious question. What should I do? There's a basic philosophical question in a way. How should I live? So what kind of materials have I got to help me decide how to live?
Yeah, a lot of them are from our own personal experience. A lot of them are from people you interact with, experiences you've had. I think maybe sometimes moral philosophers don't take entirely seriously the idea that we learn through experience, through how we interact with others. We learn over time how to behave and we build upon our prior experiences. A lot of people want to approach it straightly from theory, but I think a lot of it is actually just living in the world, seeing what happens when you interact with people in certain ways and taking feedback from that sort of thing. So a lot of it has to do with our memories of our past experiences and the way things seem to us now. And the particular topic I've been working on a lot is in how we can learn about ourselves in other ways. We can sort of see ourselves from outside through the tools of psychology. So psychologists can help us to get a fuller understanding of what we're actually like and the meaning and the values we actually hold to, the kinds of things we can't just get from reflecting on our own memories.
The way you were talking just before, I was thinking that sounds a bit like cultural transmission of values rather than choice of values. It's almost as if you learn how to be good in this society, how to do the kinds of things that are polite here. That's not what you were talking about, is it?
There's a sense in which we can't get outside of the way we've been trained to value things by the people around us, by our parents, by our societies, by our teachers. But, of course, there are many, many examples all throughout history of people who have rejected the kinds of values instilled in by their societies. So I'm not sure if we have a complete grasp on how these two things relate to each other. What does seem clear is that, descriptively speaking, it would be a mistake to deny the very strong influence of cultural background, cultural transmission, and just to suppose that we have some sort of radical freedom where we can just decide right here and right now, I'm going to value something other than what I currently value. Many of the interesting questions, I think, come out of this tension, come out of recognizing that to some extent I can revise myself, I can change the way I am, but to some extent I'm really deeply bound by contingent facts of my own psychology and background. I can't get out of them ultimately.
So that's the moral self. But what part does the study of psychology have to play in relation to that?
I think that what psychology can do is add a certain way of understanding ourselves that we don't already have. So I can understand myself already, thinking about my past experiences, thinking about imaginatively what do I think I would do in such and such circumstances. But what psychology can tell us about social psychology, neuroscience, behavioral economics, what these different empirical ways can tell us is how we actually do behave in ways that are obvious to us. You know, if I resolve that I'm going to do the recycling every week from now on, right? I'm going to help the planet, and I resolve, and I commit myself to this, and I think back, and it seems to me like I generally have done that in the past. Well, if you imagine somebody else each week, unbeknownst to me, is tracking my actual practices with regard to rubbish and recycling, and can present me next year with a list of the quantities that I recycled, that might actually be really useful to me to know. This commitment I had, I said I was going to do this important thing. Actually, I'm not actually doing it, even though I think I am, right? Because my memory is deceiving. I want to conceive myself as a person who's accomplishing this thing I thought was valuable, but in reality, and through no fault of my own, I don't have perfect memory. I can't remember exactly what I did every week. I don't have the time to sit there and track every single gram of rubbish I throw out. So if I had someone there to monitor it for me, then I'd be better equipped to figure out if I'm actually doing the thing I intended to be doing. I mean, of course, the actual psychology that's done by actual psychological researchers is usually not about me in particular. I'm not very often a participant in psychological research, so I'm making inferences. Other people have been taken into labs, and psychologists have said, make moral judgments about this and this under these and these conditions. And I have to infer that I would do the same if I were there. So I'm assuming that the people in the labs are like me. If we accept that inference, if you don't think you're special and unlike everybody else, then we can use the tools of psychology to understand ourselves better by drawing inferences from what other people do in the laboratory.
Well, if you're right, we should be in a golden age for moral development because we now have these major breakthroughs in neuroscience, in behavioral economics, in social psychology that have transformed the way that scientists and social scientists think of human beings.
Maybe the way to put it is we could be at a golden age. We have access to new forms of empirical self-understanding that pretty much all the past of human history didn't have. The kind of view that I'm sympathetic to, I think, has been, it's a common thread throughout much of Western philosophy. Aristotle, at least, had a view something like this, that in terms of understanding ourselves and dispositions and committing ourselves to acting in certain ways over time. But of course, Aristotle didn't have the technology that we have today and didn't have the kind of psychological self-assessment that's available to us today. I'm not sure if we've used it tremendously. The kind of places you can see it are often not in moral decision-making, but they're in prudential decision-making. So if you think of things that go under the title of life hacking, another buzzword is a quantified self. People keep track of how many hours they spend exercising each month and how many hours they spend writing and so forth, and they use that as feedback. They're trying to accomplish a personal goal, and they're using things like psychological self-assessment to do that. And if this is directed towards accomplishing moral things, that's in some ways mechanically similar, but of course it has a different purpose and it has different complications involved.
Could you give an example of how empirical psychology, say, could inform me in a way that would allow me to develop as an individual, a moral individual?
Yeah. Suppose that we do some psychological work on you or people like you in the laboratory, and what we can find is that certain moral intuitions that you have, certain judgments that you have, it's wrong to sacrifice one person to save five other people or something like that. The psychological origins of that judgment are things that seem strange to you, things that seem like that's not the sort of thing you should use as the basis for making this judgment. So an example that gets a lot of discussion these days is work by the neuroscientist and philosopher Joshua Green looking at the psychological and evolutionary origins of some of our moral judgments. judgments. And so roughly what he suggests is that our strong non-utilitarian judgments, the judgments that say we can't sacrifice one to save lots of people under certain circumstances, are driven by fairly primitive psychological processes. Suppose you accept that psychological picture. I mean, we could quibble about it, but suppose you accept the claims he's making psychologically, then it looks like what he's painting a picture for you is that when you make these non-consequentialist judgments, these non-utilitarian judgments, what you're doing is behaving in this primitive way. You're tapping into these ancestrally ancient primate-like judgments about basically what monkey troops need to do to get along, not what modern sophisticated human beings need to do to get along and develop societies. And if you accept all that, and if you don't conceive of yourself as being primitive in that way, then this might give you pause about these judgments you've been making. I don't accept all of the claims in that argument, but I think that roughly characterizes what's going on if, when you hear about this psychological stuff, you pause and you say, wait, I hadn't thought about myself that way. And if I do start thinking about myself that way, then maybe I'm not so committed anymore to these judgments I was making, these strong moral commitments I thought I had.
Well, if somebody tells me that my affection for my children comes from the primitive monkey-like troop thing where you have to look after your genes and look after the genes of those around you who might be your children, that doesn't devalue my love for my children.
Good, right. There's limits on this kind of thinking. I might feel that some of my judgments, they start to feel weak, they start to waver when I unmask this origin of them. Even Nietzsche himself said that when you discover the genealogy of a judgment, what it does is it gives you a feeling of hesitation about it, but that only sets the groundwork, he says, to a further analysis. So sometimes, some of our very deeply held commitments, like for example to your children, it really might not matter to you where that comes from. I don't care whether that's a primitive thing or not. That's just so important to you. I'm not going to revise that in light of anything.
Well, in that case, how do you know which of the aspects of your psychology to cling on to and which to reject as merely primitive vestiges of something that came up in the Pleistocene era?
I think that is the key question. I don't have a decisive answer to it. In fact, I don't think there is one single decisive answer. Part of the background moral theory I'm working with here, roughly a constructivist meta-ethical system where what we do in morality is try to build ourselves, our moral selves, from particular starting points. We don't suppose there is a definite right answer that we're ultimately trying to reach. And if that's the case, then there might actually be individual variability on this kind of point. What sorts of discoveries, psychological self-discoveries, actually are the kinds that can cause you to change your value system? Well, that really might be down to individuals and how you are constituted, what sorts of things are central to your system of values, and what sorts of empirical or descriptive self-characterizations are so central to how you think about yourself. Antecedently, you can't say, or I can't say, given such and such new information, you will change your moral values in such and such a way. It really does come down to how these things hang together. And the thoughtful thing to do, the work for philosophers and for people who are reflective about their own values, is to appreciate the connections and the tensions between different forms of self-characterization and different values they already hold themselves to, and try to work out some coherent and useful way of actually functioning once you start to discover some of these tensions.
This sounds as if you're moving towards a very Nietzschean view of constructing the self as something which has style, as it were, however you put the bits together.
I think that's right. I think Nietzsche is actually helpful here. So there's a book by Alexander Niemos where he talks about Nietzsche and talks about Nietzsche thinking about the self as a literary character. The different actions literary character engages in are unified in a particular way. And so the way Niemos interprets Nietzsche is that what we are aspiring to do in creating ourselves is be good literary characters. And I actually think that's quite helpful here. A lot of times what the psychology tells us is that we're not actually very good characters. We actually do lots of things that don't make sense once we put them all together in full knowledge, once we actually understand the amount of times we do the things we commit ourselves to doing and then fail to do them. And this isn't perfect, but if we want to think about one way, one positive guiding framework for what it is we're trying to do when we synthesize this descriptive self-knowledge with our commitments, is put together a compelling character, a thing that hangs together properly.
But of course, the problem with compelling characters is that the evil ones are more compelling than the good ones. And that's a problem with that sort of Nietzschean approach. If there's no viewpoint from which to judge the character as good or bad, any character is as good as any other. And possibly the more interesting ones are the ones which have got little bits of evil in there.
No, I think that's fair. So if what we're looking for is some objective Archimedean perspective from which we can sort out from all the possible characters which is the one to be, this account isn't going to give us that. And I don't think there is a way to do that. But I think that the sort of ways in which I can be in the world that are accessible to me, that I actually could be, it's actually quite limited. I can't change myself that much. These extreme examples of very evil characters, presuming I'm not already very evil, just aren't coherent possibilities for me. The coherent possibilities are people who rather like the way I am already. different ways of being in the world that are already like how I am. Psychology is like the one I already have. But that with some changes in how I am and some better self-understanding, I might be possible of changing myself in enough ways to be a better, more coherent person. But I can't just sort of spin all the dials and end up wherever I want on the long list of interesting literary characters.
Would it be fair to characterize what you're saying as this, that to be moral is at least in part to bring to awareness the kinds of patterns of behavior that you are prone to and modify them or hope to modify them in the future by holding up a mirror to yourself, which is made up of psychology, neuroscience, and anything else available?
I think that's pretty good. I think that's definitely a thing of something like that. I take it that before psychology enters the picture at all, what we're already trying to do is partly understand ourselves, introspect, think about ourselves, our memories, what we've acted like in the past, and think about how we'll be in the future. And what psychology does is add to that by allowing us to better understand what we're already like and allowing us to better understand what it would mean to act on those commitments, how empirically speaking we'd actually have to be, and what sorts of psychological tendencies we already have that accomplish those aims or do not accomplish those aims, and what sort of limitations are what we can do. So what psychology allows us to do is merely to pursue this project of moral self-knowledge and moral commitment, but do it in a more informed way and in a way that hopefully is more effective.
One way of getting self-knowledge is by introspection, reflecting on what kind of thoughts you're having, what kind of a person you are. Is that a reliable method?
Not entirely reliable. Often there are things we just can't pick up through introspection that psychology is in a better position. So a good example of this is implicit bias. It's this idea that people make negatively valence judgments about members of socially oppressed groups, so against racial minorities, against women, against all sorts of different groups. And often people are not aware they're doing this, and we can detect it through very, very precise psychological measurements, how they respond to words and pictures connoting or demonstrating those groups. But they themselves deny, and sincerely deny, that they have those biases. So if you think that you're not biased, and you value not being biased, but in fact, in ways that you aren't detecting, you're actually very slightly, very subtly biased against members of certain groups, then learning that fact about yourself would be great. If you discover that you're biased, that gives you the chance to step in and say, look, I'm going to try to correct my own judgment here. I'm going to try to take steps, institutional steps. For example, I'm going to look at resumes without knowing the name or the gender or the racial background of the people I'm interviewing for a job. And that these are steps I can take that make it more likely I'll succeed in accomplishing the thing I wanted to accomplish, being fair, but go around a deficiency in my own introspective capacity to assess fairness.
Regina Rini, thank you very much.
Thank you.
For more Philosophy Bites, go to www.philosophybites.com. You can also find details there of Philosophy Bites books and how to support us.